Should a leader call somebody that's young and inexperienced to the most important callings in your ward? This is a concept that we talk with Liz Wiseman about in this episode. She's the author of Rookie Smarts and Multipliers and recently spoke at a BYU forum.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the own and only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast, a little place where we get together and talk all things leadership related to the context of LDS leadership. My name is Kurt Frankum. I am the host of this episode and absolutely love it. I appreciate you allowing me to do this, and I hope I continue to bring you great content. This episode is no exception. We have the opportunity of sitting down with Liz Wiseman. She is so kind to the Leading LDS world, and this is not her first interview with me. I encourage you to check out those past interviews. Also, check out her books, Multipliers and Rookie Smarts. Now, listen to me here. These books need to be read by leaders in the church to be effective leaders. There are great concepts in the research there, and they're fantastic. I can't recommend them more highly. Obviously, get your scripture study in first, of course, and then let's move on to these secular thoughts and it's fantastic. What can I say more? So in this episode, like I said, sitting down with Liz Wiseman, and she recently spoke at a BYU forum. A BYU forum is similar to the devotionals, but devotionals are generally more spiritual as far as the topics. The forums are more educational, intellectual, where they bring in politicians or authors like Liz or just people with big brains in the world. And so I'll link to that forum talk. It's very, very awesome information there that you can learn from. And so I just talked to Liz about how that forum came to be, how she prepared for it, and then obviously her message that she gave at the forum and why it's so important that leaders understand the power of rookie smarts. So here's my interview with Liz Wiseman.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. And as always, I'm so grateful to welcome Liz Wiseman on this episode. How are you, Liz?
Oh, Kurt, I am doing really well. Thank you. It's good. I love talking to you, so this is going to be fun.
We'll see by the end of this episode if you still feel that way, but I'll try and keep that perspective from you. So you've been running around Provo a little bit.
I know. I feel like I've been in Utah so much over the last probably 6 months. I feel like I should probably file my taxes there or something. But it's almost been once a month. I've been out visiting BYU and a number of other places.
Yeah. Now, BYU approached you to do a forum address. So what is a forum address, or what is that? Is that what they call it?
Well, you know, what's funny was I got a call from Lee Perry, who's the dean of the Marriott School, and he'd called and left a message, and I was traveling and hadn't picked it up right away. And then he called and caught me at home, and literally I was out on my deck scrubbing this carpet. And honestly, I was in a battle with my cat, who's been peeing on my favorite rug in the dining room. And this battle's been going on for months, and I am losing this battle. And I am just intent on just power washing and scrubbing the carpet. I'm down on my hands and knees, and I'm scrubbing this thing, and I'm taking out all my anger. And Lee Perry calls to tell me that they're going to do this really wonderful Dyer Award, which is next week. And then he asked if I would come out and give a forum address at BYU. And honestly, I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, that's fine. Because I was in this battle with my cat on this carpet. And then he said, Liz, it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, this isn't a fireside chat with a handful of students, right?
Yeah, he said, no, these are the campus-wide forum addresses. And I'm like, oh, yeah, the ones that they shut down the whole campus for. And I said, okay, I'll take it seriously, Lee. Like, I'll prepare, I promise. But in the moment, I was just consumed with winning this war against my cat.
Well, it's good to hear that you're a normal person, Liz. And it's not that you are exempt from any cat attacks on your carpet like the normal folk, yeah, right?
But the BYU Forum addresses, they alternate these with the devotionals. And people sometimes say, oh, Liz, you did a devotional at BYU. And I didn't. I did a forum address. And if you are a BYU student, you know the difference between these two. The devotionals are the ecclesiastical leaders addressing the student body and the faculty. And the forums are just the plebeians, the other people, the academics and invited guests. And they really come with an academic or maybe perhaps a little bit more of a secular perspective to them.
Yeah. And it looked like you had a lot of fun up there on the podium with some rubber bands and getting people involved, which I don't think generally happens during those forum talks, right?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, they did tell me that they really wanted me to use a teleprompter. And I thought, oh, that just seems like such a grown-up thing to do. And, you know, I've been trying to avoid growing up for a while.
Nice.
And then they also said, okay, you really need to stay behind the podium. I'm like, oh, really? Do I have to? And I asked if it would be okay if we did a few things that were a little bit more fun. And what I thought was great is that the producers of BYU, of course, like, do whatever. And I, you know, there's this magical moment right before the forum. For me, it was more important than anything that happened during the forum for me was about 10 minutes prior, as they've been trying to teach me to use the teleprompter. And I'm working hard trying to learn how to do that. And there's like five different screens. And I realized I can use this, but I feel like I'll be reading a talk rather than kind of speaking from my heart and sharing some ideas very openly with the group. And one of the producers there at the Marriott Center, he said, and he kind of came in over a mic to the producer on the stage. And he said, you know what? Tell Liz that she should do whatever just is going to be natural and comfortable for her. Like, just do what is ever going to allow her to be at her best. Just do that.
Awesome.
Because they had been pushing me to use this teleprompter. And I said, you know what? Thank you. And he said, I have a feeling that you're going to be at your best if you don't use the teleprompter. I'm like, thank you. I agree. And I appreciated it because it had nothing to really do with the teleprompter or not. But to me, it was this little multiplier moment. And Kurt, you know how strongly I feel about the kinds of leaders who bring out the best in other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And cool. Yeah, they give people an environment where they really truly can be their best self or contribute their full intelligence. And I had that little multiplier moment with one of the AV staff named Mike, and I really appreciated it.
Now, I got the impression that you have some, you've had some interaction with Tom Perry, the dean there. Was he a professor of yours when you went to BYU?
Yeah, it's Lee Perry. And he is
Lee Perry. Yeah, yes. Sorry.
He's Lee T. Perry. So L, right. As he's is the son of.
Mix him up with his dad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So Lee Perry was a fairly young, I don't know if he was an associate professor at the time, but he was one of the more junior professors on staff when I was in graduate school in the MOB program, which is the Masters of Organizational Behavior program at BYU. And I was his TA.
Oh, cool.
And it was a really remarkable experience. Since I don't know, I'm sure you have an agenda for this, but I want to share just something I learned from Lee. So Lee, I have a very soft spot in my heart for Lee because one, he's an amazing person and great leader. But I TA'd for him and I was fairly young. I was still in my first year. So I was second semester, first year of the MOB program, and the internships generally went to the second years. But they had one internship to offer and I got offered it as a first year. And I wasn't excited about the internship because, wow, I'm a first year and I'm getting this internship. I was excited about it because I desperately needed this job. I was self-funding, you know, all of my undergraduate, my graduate school. So I really needed scholarships and I needed this part-time work during school. And so I was thrilled to have it. I knew I was young and maybe that there's a little bit of pressure on that. We get to the end of the semester and we get the student evaluations back and I go through them and, you know, they're mostly really good and I'm really delighted. I'm like, oh, this teaching stuff is kind of fun. And I get to one that just stops me dead in my tracks. And it said, and not like I've remembered this for 30 years or anything, but
yeah, right,
I do remember exactly what it said because it really startled me. It said, Liz brings her personal issues into class and it's distracting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it's exactly what it literally said. I might have trumped that up a bit in my memory of it, but it was basically like she brings, and I think probably what the student was implying was she tells some personal stories, which I am prone to do, which is probably. But I looked at it and I was horrified. I thought, oh, this is terrible. Obviously, I've done something wrong. And I knew I hadn't emoted to drink glass. I wasn't doing like therapy. I wasn't like, right. But I was really troubled by this. And I go marching down to Lee's office. I sit outside, wait for him. He comes in and I'm like, Lee, look at these evaluations. And I showed it to him because I was really concerned. And he grabs a stack of evaluations. I think he'd probably seen it before, but he grabs them and he's flipping through them. And he gets this big smile on his face and he sits them down and goes, Liz, these are wonderful evaluations. And he goes, see this one here with that comment about, you know, Liz brings her personal issues into class and it's distracting. He said, and he draws a bell curve on his chalkboard or whiteboard, whatever it would have been. He draws this bell curve and he said, this is an outlier. It's over here. And he draws this big X to it. He said, you should ignore that. And I'm like, oh, I like Lee Perry so much. You know, he's nice. Such a nice, yeah, great faculty. And he said, and then see these others. And he pulls a few out. Oh, Liz is amazing. Yeah, oh, great. And he goes, you should ignore those as well. And he puts a big X over on the opposite side of the bell curve. And I'm like, oh, I like Lee Perry just a little bit less, you know, right now. And he said, see this stuff in the middle. That's what you pay attention to and you manage to. And for me, it was very, very instructive, like early on learning to ignore the outliers, not just on the negative side, that's easy to do, but ignore the positive outliers or even the positive majority.
Yeah.
And learn to be dismissive of that. And so, yes, I TA'd for him. I've learned a lot of really amazing things. And I think he's actually a really, really amazing leader, and some really great things are happening for the Marriott School under his leadership.
Cool. And that makes me think back to our last interview when you, I don't know if it was a story or just sort of your mode of operation. When anybody says that they appreciate you, usually push back and say, well, why do you, what is it about me that you appreciate? Right. And because I think sometimes we can take compliments, especially in the church where, you know, we want to praise individuals for the work they're doing, but it's kind of in at the center in that bell curve that really helps us change and become better, because they're the most critical without being the outlier, right? The most ridiculous, right? That you can really find the learning there. So
absolutely.
Great story.
It's where there's substance, and you're right. I do. Well, it's a little naughty, playful side of me that does like to give people a hard time when they just say like, oh, we appreciate you, Liz. Oh, we love you. Like, well, what do you appreciate? Like, oh, we love that talk. And stuff. It's like, what did you like about it? You know, and I do think it's helpful to give people substance, because that's how we know how to improve. I just actually had a delightful conversation with my stake president just, two, 3 days ago. And he gave me some feedback that was so full of substance. It was so real that was a more meaningful, and I'm lucky to have this amazing stake president, Dal Wilson, that 30 seconds or a minute or 2 minutes of conversation was more meaningful than 100 attaboys, attagirls that are just, you know, oh, you're awesome. We appreciate you.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So Lee Perry calls you, you're scrubbing your floors, cursing your cat's name, and here you are on the schedule to give a forum at BYU. And obviously with your research background, your books, you've probably, I'm sure that's, I don't know if they had to tell you directly, but I'm sure it was assumed that that's the content on which they wanted you to speak, or how did it come to that?
Actually, it was a guidance from Dean Perry as well. When I was running a few ideas by him that I thought maybe I might talk about, he goes, Liz, we want to hear about your research. Tell us about your research. And, you know, very particularly, I think Lee has been very, I should say Dean Perry, has been very struck with this idea of leader as multiplier. And I think he wanted to share that. And I think for him, it was a little bit personal as well. Lee was writing his father's biography, and he said that he had kind of this really, for me, it's a very touching personal moment as well when he's writing his father's biography and trying to kind of tell the story of his father. And he said, when I was doing that, is that's when I had read the book Multipliers. And he said, it really helped me understand who my father was. He said, of course, I knew my father very well, but it was this lens that I looked at my father. You know, my father wasn't the best at this or that, but what his gift was is he made everyone around him better. He was that kind of a leader. And I think, you know, Dean Perry wanted me to share that idea broadly. So this idea of leader as multiplier, the kinds of leaders who bring out the very best in people around them, not just leaders who make people feel good. That's the, oh, wow, you're so awesome kind of leader, but the leader who really sees genius and capability in other people and then not just supports it, but then challenges it and puts it to use and sort of dares it into new challenging arena. So the idea of leader as multiplier, and then also this idea that comes out of my research for the book Rookie Smarts is that it's a fairly simple idea, is that we tend to do our best thinking and we tend to do our best work not when we're operating in the area of our expertise or experience, but when we're new to something, because it forces us, it compels us into a mode of inquiry. It compels us into a place of humility. And it's a place where we inquire, we draw on the expertise of others. We're a little bit shameless in that we don't feel shame for not knowing. And so we ask the right questions, we experiment, we make mistakes. We take in feedback very willingly because we need it. We're sort of sponges for feedback. And I found that, you know, while we think that when we're rookies and new and we think that we're sort of bumbling, clueless clods, it's actually a space that we tend to do our best work in. And, you know, for me, here's the real kicker. It's also a space where we tend to experience our greatest joy.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Now, going back when you mentioned the Lee Perry writing the biography of his father, it makes me realize how difficult it is to, I don't know, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong through your research in identifying multipliers, because usually, just like, you know, Dean Perry had kind of that maybe an eye-opening moment when he's analyzing the life of his father, when he realized, oh, well, he was a multiplier. Is it difficult as you did your research to find these multipliers? Because generally it's individuals I found in my life that I'm just like, you know, everything seems to be really well run. Everything seems to work when they're at the helm of things. And I don't know why, but for some reason I like being around them and I want to be part of that team. Would you say it's hard to find or label people multipliers until you kind of have that research?
You know, it isn't hard. When we ask people to identify a leader who is a multiplier to them and a leader who is a diminisher to them, virtually everyone can come up with one or the other. Truth be told, people tend to think of their diminishers first. Like that, that tends to be, so it's not hard to come up with multipliers. It just is easier to come up with diminishers because they leave a scarring experience with us. You know, we tend to carry the scars of the diminishers. And, you know, some people have read multipliers and said, wow, it's like a lens, like the story with Lee Perry, who said, wow, it helped me bring his father's life into focus for him a little bit because he could see he was absolutely a multiplier. For other people, it has incredible value for the other reason. It helps to bring the diminishers in their life into focus. Like, wow, almost in a therapeutic kind of way. Wow, that's what was going on. I mean, of course, you can imagine I'm a magnet for diminisher stories. I get trapped in elevators where people are like, I need to tell you about my diminisher. I'm like, bring it on. But people say like, man, I read your book and I hear a lot of people say reading the book was painful. Because they're seeing their own diminisher. People are like, wow, I do a lot of these things you describe in these diminishing leaders. But for some people, it's liberating reading it because they're like, oh, I thought it was me. And really now when I look back on that situation, the reason why I was a bumbling fool was because of the way that that person was leading and the dynamics of a relationship. Now that doesn't rule out the fact that they might've in that case been a bumbling fool. Like, you know, you know, like we all have brilliance, but we all have a little bit of capacity to be idiots, you know, at times in our lives. But it helps people to see that the effect that diminishing leaders have had on them. And yet, you know, people tend to gravitate sharply to these diminishing leaders because these leaders are often big and present. Some of them are the narcissistic bully type. Honestly, for me, those aren't the interesting ones. The real interesting, and I hope this isn't an idea that came out of the talk. I had to move through it kind of quickly, but what I hope really came out of the talk was what I found in my research, you know, while I set out to sort of uncover, expose, eradicate these tyrannical bully type leaders, that I found that most of the diminishing done inside of our organizations, and I would go, well, inside of our organizations is done by really well-intended leaders.
Yeah.
Nice people wanting to do a good job leading, but yet are having this diminishing effect. And you know, of course, we call this the accidental diminisher. And, you know, we see it not only in the workplace, we see it in our homes, and we see it in our wards all the time. Leaders with the best of intentions were having diminishing impact.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And really, that's my hope is helping people understand, you know, these diminishing concepts. And not that we'll go into that a lot in this interview, just because I know that the message, I felt like walking away from the forum after listening to it, that it was very motivational, because for a room full of students, you know, aspiring individuals who the world's ahead of them, you know, once I get my degree, I'm it's me and the world, and I'm going to take it on. That they this message of that the power of not knowing, right, and that's actually an advantage to you as a student coming out of college. Was that sort of the overall message you really wanted to drive home? Because I think you did that very well.
Well, then that must have been the message that I was trying to drive home. You know, I, as I was listening to describe that, you know, kind of what popped in my head is, I think my fundamental message is, don't end up so smart that you're an idiot. And don't end up so smart that you make idiots all around you. And this to me is the unifying message behind the research that I've done, is leaders can rely so heavily on their own intelligence that they end up shutting down people around them. They essentially become too smart for the good of others, that others can't be big around them. And that's the idea of multipliers. But there's also this idea of, don't get so caught up in acquiring knowledge and demonstrating competence, which you feel a lot of pressure about time, you know, second semester of your senior year, or kind of the end of the grad year run, that you end up becoming irrelevant. You know, you've acquired knowledge, but very few people today are being hired for their knowledge. You know, we're being hired for our ability to solve problems. You know, it's not the knowledge that we bring to our employers
that matters.
It's the knowledge and know-how that we're going to build later. Because right now, with the world spinning so fast, that how fast we learn is more important than what we know. And so we can know ourselves right out of relevance. We can blind ourselves to new possibilities. We can miss things entirely. We can start to see what we want to see, what we expect to see. And meanwhile, the world is changing and we miss it. So really, my talk was an invitation to stay in the space of not knowing.
Yeah. And do you feel like the world's approach to that is sometimes a little backwards when we're expected to, you know, send a resume in for a job where that resume shows more about what you know, or maybe that's the fault of the maker of the resume, that they should construct that in a way that shows maybe how situations that challenged you to learn quickly and how you overcame that?
Yeah. Well, I think most of our tools for recruiting and for presenting ourselves are based in a very old world way of doing things, where we demonstrated knowledge, but the world now is cycling so fast that one of the stats, I don't know if I shared this in the talk, but when you look at people working in the STEM fields and you calculate, I did a bunch of calculations to come up with this number, but you calculate the rate at which knowledge is increasing, you know, that more and more information is now available to us. And then you also factor in the rate at which knowledge is becoming obsolete. You know, things don't actually stay true for very long. That if you work in science, technology, engineering, or math, or any industry that's heavily influenced by those, you know, it's very sort of got a strong technological bedrock underneath the industry, is about 15% of what you know today is likely to be relevant in 5 years. I had to have my research assistant is a total quant, and she recalculated this number 3 times because we wanted to make sure we really had it right. Because it's not 50% as in half, it's 15 as in 1/5. And I find that really shocking, 15% of what we know today. And what that means is people coming out of college are not immune to that either. That what they learned in college, that most of that, you know, 4 or 5 years later is not going to be relevant. But yet having resumes and skills and GPA, it does matter, because what those are trophies of a learning process. I know, Kurt, you have 2 children, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and fortunately, yours are still in that yummy, fun, but chaotic stage before they're off to school and in
very chaotic. Yes.
Very chaotic. It, you know, so mine are all in the rat race years of school. Yeah. And one of the hardest things for me to do as a mom, well, there's lots of hard things about being a mom, but one of the hardest things is to sit back and not interfere with natural processes and natural learning processes. And one of the things that's one of them that's hard for me not to do is to step in and tell my kids that what they're studying and what they're consternating about actually isn't really important at all. You know, as they're, you know, memorizing the capitals of Europe, or, you know, they're working on differential calculus or whatever it is. And I look at what they're studying and I realize most of that they're never going to need to know. They're never actually going to use that. And part of me wants to interfere in that process and say, don't worry your pretty little head over that, because you're not going to need to know that. You can look it up. But then what I realize is the process they're going through is they're learning how to learn. And that A that they're striving for isn't really saying, it's not a certification that, hey, they know this. What it meant, that A means, is that they were able to know it.
Yeah.
And they've built the discipline of learning. And that is really, I think, what we need to be able to demonstrate coming out of college, is that I have been through a process that teaches me how to solve problems quickly, how to do the death march, you know, and and get a paper delivered and get a project delivered on time and well. And then in some ways to be able to dispose of it and go to the next thing, because the business cycle cycles through the semester model, like every couple of weeks, like, okay, here's a new project. Okay, forget that. Now here's another one. And I think work is about constantly scrambling up these new learning curves. And I think that's what we have to be able to demonstrate. And grades and resumes and GPAs are a surrogate for that, but they need to be living, almost like a living track record of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. And a fantastic message for students, but really anybody who's looking to progress in life, and that process of learning, we should keep those learning muscles sharp and fresh and moving, you know, and growing. And so, Liz, I want to kind of pivot a little bit deeper into church leadership here, and maybe let me set up a scenario for us to use here and talk about. And this is an actual scenario. The ward that I served as bishop in, I served for 4.5, almost 5 years. And then now I'm in the state presidency where I'm currently serving. And obviously we called, since I got put in the state presidency, we called a replacement to be bishop in that ward. Well, he did a great job. He was actually my first counselor when I was released. Fantastic bishop, really, really good at what he did. And just followed the same pattern of having a really young bishop in that ward. Well, his wife suddenly became pregnant with twins, and it was obvious that they could not live in their living situation and they needed to move. And so just this week they moved. And so last Sunday, After much thought and prayer, we called in as the stake presidency, as the stake presidency, we called in a new person to extend this calling to him and his wife. Well, this individual is 25 years old. He's never held an official leadership calling. And as I, in the church, you could say, and as I sat there in the room, I looked at him and I said, please understand, as somebody who has been that very young bishop that really didn't know what he was doing, the fact that you don't know what you're doing will be more of an advantage to you than if you came in here with decades of experience in bishoprics and, leadership callings. And that's where I feel like this message of Ricky Smarts is so powerful to the local leader, because even if that bishop or bishopric is called in their 60s or 70s, there's still this level of Ricky Smarts happening, because they may be a plumber or an electrician, or they didn't go to MBA school to understand how to run organizations. But nonetheless, the Ricky Smarts is alive and well in the church. But nonetheless, I'm standing on the sidelines with this new bishop. He actually lives directly across the street from me. And I'm just chomping at the bit to go over there and say, all right, here's all the problems that I ran into, and here's how I fixed them, and make sure you do this and this, and oh yeah, don't make this mistake, whatever you don't make that mistake. But I'm going back to my core values, Liz, and thinking, okay, let's not jump in here, and let's let him unfold in this calling naturally and discover things for his own. Right.
I love this idea of unfolding in a calling.
Right. Yeah. So what are your thoughts with that? With it, just taking this young bishop at 25, I mean, what encouragement would you give him? Where would he start with being comfortable with being able to learn young at such a calling?
Oh, well, first of all, so I want to make sure I understand this. So you were in serving as bishop, and you were also a young bishop. And I remember you were serving before you had even had children. So you were underqualified on some family issues as well.
Absolutely.
And I remember you sharing that. And then there was another new bishop, a young bishop called, but then moved, and that was moved out of the ward, you said?
Yeah, he moved out of the ward into a larger home for his growing family.
Yeah, so, and then another new bishop. So you've got a whole series of young bishops, and they're getting younger, which is making me laugh, because isn't the bishop, don't we talk about the bishop being kind of like the president of like the priest quorum?
Right. Yeah. And he's fitting in quite well.
Yeah, so I'm saying, okay, you're actually going down to the point where that is actually becoming more and more true. So that's really, really interesting. So you've got a very young bishop. I think there's two sides of this that I find so interesting. One is like, what advice do people have for that bishop? Like, where should that bishop start? But I think you've already brought up the part of it that's more interesting, which is what advice for the people that are in his support community, the ecosystem,
right.
Because I think you've hit on something really interesting is, there is a tendency to want to go and shore people up. And this is really interesting, because part of the trick of like the beauty of Ricky Smarts is that when people are underqualified, they tend to do their best work. Part of it is because of who they are. They're unencumbered by a lot of baggage. They're more willing, to ask questions, to think fresh. It's kind of, what in Eastern philosophy they call the beginner's mind.
Yeah.
Part of it is a hunger that they bring, a need to prove themselves, that they, tend to come out of the gate really wanting to contribute. But part of it also has to do with the fact that they are reaching out and they're drawing upon the expertise of others and bringing it into bear. One of the things that we found in the research is that when people are inexperienced, they end up, they're two times more likely to consult with experts than when they are experienced themselves. And when they do, they consult with a lot more experts, five times more. So if you put an intelligent, underqualified person into a role, what they're likely to do is they're likely to reach out to other experts. And they end up bringing to bear more expertise on the problems by the sheer fact that they don't have it themselves. Whereas someone who has expertise, you know, naturally draws on it and doesn't need to reach that far beyond themselves. So, you know, where do you start? You start by identifying, you know, if you're this new bishop, you start by identifying kind of the questions and who you need to draw on and who you need to go out and seek out for expertise. You know, and I, part of the beauty of this, it's actually something I heard Elder Bednar say, and I think he spoke about, I'm actually on a sidebar to a sidebar to a sidebar on this issue, Kurt, but I find it so fascinating. I want to jump, do a little bit of a jump cut to another sidebar with, this is something Elder Bednar spoke about in the October conference, and it was something I had heard him speak about on another occasion. I had told my daughter about it, and when my daughter, who's off at college now at Berkeley, she was watching conference. She starts sending me this text message. Mom, are you watching this live? You've got to see what Elder Bednar's talking about. It's the thing that you've been telling me about. And he talked about why the advantages of age with our general authorities. And it wasn't about the idea that with age comes wisdom, but is that when you are in your advanced years, you might not have some of the spring in the step, and you might not be sort of at your sharpest. I'm now 51, and I'm already starting to see like, oh, some parts aren't as sharp as they used to be. But it forces you to draw elsewhere. And one of the things I remember Elder Bednar saying is him being the young member of the quorum, he said, it is so clear to me who is leading the church. And it is not the president, the presidency, the quorum. The Lord is leading the church. Because, you know, the people at the top are often, they're not the people with the answers. They're the people with the questions, and they know where to turn. So, you know, when you can now come back to a young bishop, you know, the beauty of someone who feels like, I don't know what I'm doing, I've never done that before, it forces them to turn outward to maybe the past bishop, to other people, to friends, to families, but it forces them to turn upward in probably ways that someone with years of experience might say, oh, I got this. I know how to do it. And I think it's that turning outward on a peer level and turning upward to the Lord is where that power comes in. And this idea about not truncating, not aborting that learning process, because we do want to jump in. We want to jump in, we want to rescue. And there's incredible beauty of not doing it, of letting that person come to you if and when they need it. But to let that process truly unfold. And I would probably liken this to the process of becoming a new parent. This is probably maybe even more relevant for the women than for the men. I think men get it as well, but women are more magnets for it when, you know, a woman is pregnant or a couple is expecting. You get these kind of wonderful smiles from most people. And I just think it's amazing that and we find this in across cultures, is that people just underbrief you about what's about to happen. People go like, oh, like, I don't know what they even say. They're just like, oh, I'm so happy for you. Like, oh, the roller coaster begins. And they just kind of give this knowing smile. But, you know, rarely do people sit down and say, Kurt, let me tell you what's about to happen to your family, you know, and they really don't share this. Now, maybe there are some Budinsky types that do, but probably shouldn't. But, you know, you think, wow, no one told me, nobody told me, nobody told me. And I think it's by design. And I think experienced parents just know, let this person figure it out. You know, let their own learning process unfold. And I will be standing right here, ready to help when they hit a wall.
Yeah. You know, I love the reference to Elder Bednar's talk, because it's so true when, because there's always, I remember as being bishop, I always had that stake president to turn to with questions, right? And and even state presidents somewhat feel, you know, they each have an area authority or whatever they can call and counsel with. But the higher up the hierarchy you go, it seems like there's less and less mortals to turn to, right? And so I can't imagine being on some of those higher councils where literally the only place you have to turn to for answers is that divine source. But at the same time, you realize, you know, that's how it should be on every level. That's we and to be that leader that sort of knowingly disconnects a little bit from that new leader and saying, you know, I'm going to let you flounder a little bit, knowing that you'll turn to the right place for those answers. And if I'm part of that, you know, council that you come to me as a past leader of the ward that understands these dynamics you're facing, then I'm okay with that too, and I'm happy to help. But I'm definitely, and I think a lot of leaders face this where they do kind of want to run and rescue, right? I mean, we've talked about this, you've talked about this over and over again, that is just, it's not allowing them to grow and find those answers on their own and have a deeper understanding of the lesson they learned because they let that, you know, that wave of understanding hit them right in the face and bury them into the sand, you know?
Well, I mean, the Lord's pattern of leadership is so clear. And if you look at how it manifests itself in so many ways, you know, you start with God's plan and agency. And from that, you can extrapolate the way that we're to lead in so many different environments, you know, as parents. You know, it is not a hands-off experience raising your children, but you can't give them answers. You can't tell them what to do. Even when your kids come to you begging, like, Mom, what should I do? It, you know, the only responsible answer is that they have to figure that out for themselves. But then there are also these moments where you can be a sounding board or hold a mirror up, and you can be a catalyst for helping someone see, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is our relationship with God, and it's how we're to lead in our homes and in our churches. And I'm absolutely convinced it's how we're to lead in the workplace. I really don't see them as different.
Yeah.
I think they're just different applications of a pattern of leading and learning that's already been established for all of us. And it's available to everyone, not just members of the church.
Yeah. What would you say to, you know, a bishopric who's in their office late night trying to figure out the next Relief Society president or the next Elders Quorum president? Because I've been in many of these meetings and we're always defaulting to what experience does that individual have so they don't light anything on fire when we put them in this calling, right? And you've talked about through your research shows that it's, again, it's not about the experience. It's not about what this person knows or that they've done this one before, so they should be fine. How can a leader just let go of that comfort of experience and say, you know, we're going to kind of put a dark horse in this calling, and they, you know, they're faithful, they're worthy. Let's see how they do.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we often cling to experience because it's comfortable. We think, okay, well, someone's done it before, they should be able to do it again. But it really is a false indicator. And I think I see two things that, you know, and I haven't, you know, obviously been in a bishopric or been in a role where making these callings, but these are just things that I observe. When I look at some of the leaders locally, one of the things I see is these callings, when they just feel like they're exactly right.
Yeah.
They're usually a statement of where someone's heart is and where their development needs lie. And, you know, maybe this is a little bit personal. My husband's in another room, so he won't hear me sharing this.
Oh, good. All right.
And I don't think he's going to listen to the podcast, but he just got called into a bishopric and he was like, oh, I'm no good at any of these things. You know, my skills lie elsewhere. And when our new bishop sat him down and was talking to him, it's like, but Larry, this is the kind of heart that you have. And it was a bishop who could see that he loved the Lord. And that he had a heart of a saint. And he really does. You know, my husband like, he hates meetings. He, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff about being in a bishopric that it's like, you would, if you were basing it on a resume and proclivities, you would not see this as an obvious calling. But he has such a good heart. He really does have the heart of a saint. And the bishop is like, that's what I need. I need your heart. I need the heart of a minister, not the time management skills of an administer. You know, someone who, and I think what I've learned in the last few years serving in the church is that, yeah, there's a part of our work that we administer, but that you don't administer the church or the gospel, that you minister. And it really is not a one-to-many relationship. It's a one-to-one relationship. And I think sometimes we are so we see the administrative skills of people, and we get that confused with people who minister. So I think, you know, it really is about the heart. And, you know, we know this, yeah. You know, we just got done memorizing the scripture mastery, you know, from Samuel about the calling of Daniel. And it's, you know, and the Lord doesn't look on the outer, you know, appearance or the height of a stature, but the Lord looks on the heart. And I'm feeling nervous quoting the scripture because I know I'm going to get a few things wrong.
We can edit this to make it sound.
It's okay. I'm going to just have to paraphrase it. But it's that you know, man doesn't see the way that God sees. That man looks on the outer, you know, appearance, and the Lord looks on the heart. And sometimes somebody's heart is very different than what their professional or even ecclesiastical resume might look like. And I think we're all called into places where we need, and, you know, where we need to grow. And I think this is often one of the hard things for members of the church, because we often see people put into callings who are like, really? You know, like, yeah. And like, this is supposed to be my role model, my leader. Like, wow, this is someone who really struggles. And some of my favorite leaders, some of my favorite Relief Society presidents and presidencies have been people who are struggling and who are so open with their own struggles and where they have wandered and come back. And I think they are incredibly powerful leaders. But this is the beauty of the way that we serve in our callings, is that just at the time we get to like a calling, you know, when we first get called, we feel uncomfortable. We're no good at it. We're underqualified. We don't know how to do it. We sort of mumble our way and we figure it out. We get good at it. We come to love the people, because it is a universal principle. We come to love those that we serve and we love them. And we think to ourselves, I love my calling. They better not change it. And like, you start avoiding eye contact with the bishopric, you know, and, you know, you kind of hover over this calling, and it's just the moment that we get good at it and we come to love it that we're ripped away from it, and we go kicking and screaming, you know, as one author said, kicking and screaming into the dark night of the unknown, and we get put into a calling and we kind of hate it. We're like, no, I don't like this. I don't know how to do it. I'm no good at it. I don't love these people yet. And it's in this state of underqualified that we often turn upward to the Lord. We figure it out. We come to love the people. And then it happens again. Like, I hope they don't call me to something else because I love this. And we get ripped right out of it.
And I think that the gospel truly is that the essence of rookie smarts. And I love what you said about focusing on the heart, and I'm not trying to rewrite your book or anything, but the, you know, rookie smarts is really that trying to measure that rookie heart. And every characteristic of a rookie that makes them ideal for, you know, the unknown responsibilities is the fact that their heart drives them so much that they find the answers and they find the highest level of creativity because they're in that situation of being uncomfortable, right?
Right. And can you maintain a rookie heart?
That's the trick.
And it's funny, I'll just tweak a little bit what you said. I think you said that rookie smarts is the essence of the gospel. I want to make just a little editorial correction. It's probably more like,
oh, okay.
The gospel is really the essence of rookie smarts.
All right.
It would probably be more accurate. Not that, and that's really coincidental.
Let the record show.
Yeah,
all right.
Please let the record show that I think the gospel and what we know about how we learn is really at the heart of how we contribute. And I think it is the powerful question. Can you maintain a rookie mind and can you maintain a rookie heart? Because a rookie heart is one that is humble and it is one that is hopeful. But it's also one that is hungry as well.
Perfect.
It's kind of like, that's why I love missionaries so much. It's why I volunteer to go in and teach missionaries, because they have this rookie heart. They are at, and this is one, Kurt, you and I have probably talked about this, but this is one where I think there is an incredible opportunity. I don't think we've maximized this opportunity as a church yet, is to like really maximize the leadership learning of our young missionaries. I know that the time I have spent doing this has delivered back, you know, 100-fold kind of results, because these young men and women are in such, it's this combination of living by the Spirit and being guided by the Spirit and having the Spirit with them at all times, for the most part, of course. But then couple that with this total sense of desperation of, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm in over my head, and then they keep giving me leadership callings and now I'm really in over my head. And this creates this powerful, like it's this perfectly optimized petri dish for learning. But I look at missionaries, I think that is a rookie heart. Hungry, hopeful, humble, you know, willing to learn and seeing that anything is possible. I think of my daughter before she went off. She's serving right now in the Barcelona mission. And, you know, after she got called to a European mission, she got the normal kind of like, oh, that's great. That's sort of exotic. That's not a hardship place to learn. Oh, probably not going to baptize very many people, you know, and people instantly go. And yeah. I even, as her mother, was like, well, honey, you know, there are multiple measures of success in a mission. And see, fortunately, my daughter got her call in summer and she didn't report until January. So she had this semester available to go back to school. So she went back for another semester at BYU, where she encountered a number of returned missionaries from the Barcelona mission. And they all kind of looked her in the eye and in one way or the other said, like, don't let anyone tell you that you're not going to see baptisms in Europe. Let anyone tell you that. And they went on, you know, gave her all this. And she came home and she's kind of like, Mom, we will be baptizing. And I don't want you to think about that. And just, again, it's this hungry, humble, and hopeful way of working. And I think our missionaries have it. Like, if not only every member of missionary, you know, we think about, okay, this opportunity and this obligation of missionary work on members. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if every member could have the heart of a missionary? Like, if we just had that,
yeah,
we as a people would be amazing. And well fed, too, so don't you think?
Absolutely. So if you wrote this book for the LDS audience, it would be a young 19-year-old missionary smarts.
Yeah, something
right?
like that. But I just admire missionaries.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a perfect message, Liz. Anything we're missing? I mean, I feel like obviously the talk was on various subjects, but I feel like that message that you shared is perfect. Should we cut it off there, or am I missing anything?
Well, I think the fundamental message is that I think there's a real practical message in here as well. I think there is about maintaining this hungry, hopeful heart, you know, that it's this idea that the glory of God is really intelligence, but it's in seeking, not knowing, that we come to find light and truth. And I think this is where we discover the glory of God. Yes, can we maintain this way of being? But I think there's also a very simple and practical side of this as well. And this is maybe what I would leave with, is I would just encourage us all to be very quick to say yes the things that we don't know how to do, instead of defaulting to no, default to, I think this is, might be a Pippi Longstocking's quote. It's like, I've never done anything like that before, so that should be no problem at all. And it's a different way of living. It's a different way of working. But I've seen incredible power in my own life of just being quick to say, yeah, I'll do that, and then figure it out later.
That concludes my interview with Liz Wiseman. I hope you appreciated that interview as much as I did. I was taking notes and really considering how I'm going to be not only help and shepherd those younger leaders that I work with, but also be a leader, a young leader myself, you know, have those rookie smarts as a leader and continue to learn and figure out how to learn quickly and stumble quickly and improve quickly. Again, I don't know if you really understand the honor it is that Liz is so willing to give of her time to leading LDS. Now, leading LDS, we have a decent following. We have a lot of people listening in, but I'm not going to act like we're this huge, you know, leadership organization quite yet. And so the fact that this best-selling author is so willing to come and let me ask her questions that I can send out to all of you listeners listening in is phenomenal. So take some time and send her a message, send her an email, go buy her book and study it. It is worth every investment that you have in reading this information. So it's fantastic. As always, I encourage you to go to leadinglds.com/help, H-E-L-P. And there's a variety of ways that you can contribute to Leading LDS. I need your help. That's the bottom line. It is just me, Kurt Frangum, that started this thing and is trying to push it forward. And the more help I can get, the better. And from the Facebook group, the Leading LDS helpers, to just individuals who are willing to make images, review information, then I suddenly feel like, you know what? It's not just me. There's so many involved and I appreciate it. So please go there and find a way you can help. I know many of you are busy leaders, but find a way you can help. Even 5 minutes, one day, there's something you can do. So until next time, be a leader and not a colleague.